Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Happy spooky Halloween week.
Yes. Are you going to go dressed up trick-or-treating?
I don't know if I've ever dressed up for Halloween. My wife is mad on it because she's American. And a lot of people will get angry if you talk about Halloween. They say it's an Americanism invading our culture. But I just think it's just another thing, isn't it, to give the year a bit of shape.
I first did it when I was seven. I think it's the only time I really remember when I was living in America. And it was obviously a massive thing in America then. And it was not a thing at all, I don't think, in Britain.
So what did you...
Was it a thing when you were growing up? Like, I know you grew up a long time after me, but...
I think there was like a little stuff, like bobbing for apples seems to be a thing, and a bit of ghouls and ghosts.
Penny for the guy.
It was all the same kind of time, wasn't it? Yeah. So when you were seven, what did you go as then?
I think I had a sort of skeleton, one of those skeleton costumes.
Yeah,
but I remember I went to one house and they, I know it's going to sound really peculiar, but it's what I have like etched in my mind. I think they didn't really like kids going to Halloween, so they like gave you some like horrible goulash or something. Which then sort of, you know, in your bag.
That'll teach you to not come back.
Exactly. And you're sort of slightly, I've got a sort of memory of this.
Yeah, you should have goulash.
Goulash.
Goulash, that's what they were getting at.
Maybe I've now discovered it 40 years later.
The other thing is this week is it's budget week.
Yeah, talking of scary.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is it scary when you were in the Treasury team? Is it a week you look forward to or is it a week you dread?
It depends what the sort of situation was. Gordon Brown, you see it as a big sort of, big opportunity for Gordon Brown to sort of shape, you know, government policy. He used to sort of basically trample over everybody else's areas. I have various memories of it, as you can imagine. But one of my strongest memories is basically Gordon used to care about the narrative of the speech and used to be not so interested in the detail. I mean, if it was like raising taxes for the NHS, he'd be interested. But in general, he was like not at all interested in detail. He wanted to leave the detail to everybody else.
Yeah.
And he found the detail incredibly annoying. And he found us, it was particularly me and Ed Balls, not being around to work on his speech. He used to type the speech in very sort of concentrated way, shall we say. And then from early on, there was a big screen in his room so you could see what he was typing.
Okay.
And then you say, well, what do we say now? It was an exhaustive and exhausting process.
You see, when you're describing this, it sounds to me like a scene from The West Wing.
Yeah, I think we've sort of had West Wing-ish qualities. Yeah. We could have done with Martin Sheen.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about plastic this week.
Yes.
And you've been particularly interested in this recently because you watched a documentary.
I did, by Liz Boneen, with Liz Boneen on the BBC, which with my kids, and it was quite shocking. You know, you'd see sort of poor sort of seals that had died from, you know, ingesting plastic. And it's awful, isn't it? It's just a massive, massive problem. I think it's interesting in itself. What do we do about the problem? But it's also interesting in a wider sense, because I think people do feel really mobilized, partly because of David Attenborough and Blue Planet too. And what does that tell us about how you mobilize people on environmental issues? So we're going to be talking about that.
And then as well as all that, our comedian this week in here to share some of his ideas is Rich Wilson.
Yep. So what's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful, I mentioned this very briefly at the end of last week's podcast. I went to see Hamilton and it was fantastic. I loved it. And I do think raving about it is akin to saying, hey, I heard this great new pop star. You might not have heard of her, Beyonce, because it is such a phenomenon.
Who is she exactly?
Yeah, well, Ed's the one person who would legitimately ask that question. But I mean, I know it is this worldwide phenomenon, but it is just brilliant.
And if I'm not like that keen on musicals, I'll still like it. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah,
I'm thinking of going on Christmas Eve, which is my birthday. There's a showing at 2:30. My wife and I have been discussing it.
You should definitely do it.
Yeah. My reason to be cheerful is that we are going to be an exhibit at the British Museum.
We are.
Yeah.
It's not going to be like that German fella who preserves corpses and slices them open and uses.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say we're going to be an exhibit, I don't quite mean we're going to be an exhibit, but we got, sorry to disappoint, we got a fantastic email from Robert Bracey, who's the curator responsible for South and Central Asian coins. Now, you might be asking, what have we got to do with that? But this is what it says. The British Museum is planning an exhibition, Playing with Money, which looks at how money is represented in games and toys. We're planning to include a section on games that satirise or are critical of political or economic issues. One of the games we were planning to display parts of was Class Struggle.
Wow.
A colleague pointed me to the Christmas episode of your podcast where you played the game, and I thought the use in the podcast of Mr. Miliband, that's me, childhood experience, might enhance the story we're trying to tell.
Definitely.
So, now, there's a confession I have to make, which is that some very nice people, the Douglases, lent us Class Struggle. It's still 9-10 months later sitting in my house, because I keep meaning to return it to them. And actually, they want to auction it off at a fundraiser signed by me, a Labour Party fundraiser. But I'm rather hoping that they are going to sort of auction it off, but sort of with a delay, so that it can be displayed at the British Museum. But the other thing to say is, because I've been in touch with Robert Bracey about this, if other people have got other games that they think would be good for this Playing with Money, particularly if they're sort of mad lefty games, let us know.
This is great. And in terms of auctioning it off, surely it having been an exhibit in the British Museum only increases its value.
Well, let's hope. We're going to talk to the Douglases.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're delighted to be joined now by Catherine Conway from Unpackaged. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Thought maybe the first thing we should ask you is can you tell us what Unpackaged is and what you do?
So Unpackaged was the first zero waste grocery, and I set it up as a small shop in 2006 in London with the idea that people could come and bring their own containers to refill as a way of not getting new packaging.
And what motivated you to set it up?
Because as a customer, that's how I wanted to refill. So there are some shops that offer some refill products like Ecoverse, so you could refill your washing up liquid bottle in some small health food shops. And I remember going to fill up my Ecoverse, but then coming back with all of this packaging for dry goods and literally sitting over my bin going, this is crazy. If I can refill washing up liquid, why can't I refill everything? And then I sort of had the idea to set a shop up with no retail experience.
And how did it go? Did it capture people's imagination?
It did. It was really hard. I started as a market stall, and for a lot of the time, I didn't even sell enough to cover the congestion charge to get to the market. But slowly, slowly, people started cottoning on. But back in those days, there was nothing about plastics packaging in the news. There was no sort of concept of zero waste. So it was quite an uphill struggle. It was the beginning of the global financial crisis. So it was a hard time to set up a new kind of concept. But slowly, slowly, we morphed from a market stall into a small shop in Islington, where we had 700 products available in refills. Then we moved to a bigger store in Hackney, and now I have concessions within Planet Organic in London, with the idea that to try and create a model that isn't just me in my little store, but is actually taking the concept out and putting it in supermarkets and actually trying to get it to a mainstream audience.
And how is that going?
Since Blue Planet at Christmas, off the charts. So it's been quite a long time coming. But when Blue Planet aired, all of the conversations we were trying to have with bigger businesses suddenly got accelerated. And now everyone is interested in packaging all of the time at
and
the same
time. And so they want to work with you.
They want to work with us. So whether it's us coming in and designing sections for them, whether it's us just going in and trying to inspire their team on how they could make changes. But there's clearly a massive consumer demand for it now, and retailers want to respond to it.
How practical is it to do it at scale in large supermarkets? And presumably, if there's a will, it's possible.
Yeah, I think not all products are going to be able to be refilled, but just because you can't refill everything doesn't mean you shouldn't refill something. So there are some products that it's really easy to do. You know, your glass milk bottles is a really good example. So something like in London, there's been a 200-something% increase in demands for milk in glass bottles as a way of solving the plastic
crisis. Since Blue Planet.
Since Blue Planet. There are some products it's very easy to do. You can do dry goods very easily. You can do, you know, like an old-fashioned pick and mix. You know, that's not hard. But actually now, some of the supermarkets, so Morrison's, Waitrose and Tesco's will all allow you to bring your own container to their deli counters. So you could buy any fish, meat or cheese products in your own containers.
I hate to ask this, but what about people who shop on the interweb?
This is the real challenge. So working out how to do refill and reuse in delivery is really hard, but the advance of tech, in inverted commas, is what's going to help that. So there's lots and lots of interesting models which are coming up, which is about reusable packaging systems. Things are becoming a lot cheaper, like RFID tags.
What's that?
So it's a way of tracking something. So if you look at, so I bought a John Lewis item the other day, and the packaging had an RFID tag impregnated in it because it's a way of doing stock control. So people don't go and count stock anymore in stock rooms. They
so
have
why
a massive
does that help
laser.
With this problem?
Because if you could have a reusable packaging system that was trackable, then I could give you a coffee cup or I could give you a piece of packaging and it could be linked to your smartphone in some way, shape or form. And you could be incentivized to bring that back to me as a shop
or I
could come and pick it back up again on a delivery.
So
there's all of this stuff. I mean, there's potentially some unintended consequences. Like, do we really want to track thousands and millions of pieces of packaging around people's homes? But I think the end game is probably not having customers self-dispensing products in stores. The end game is probably more vending machines, more automation.
Can I ask a really stupid question? When I get a plastic milk carton and then throw it away, or into recycling, that isn't good.
It's really not good.
Because what happens?
So what happens? Because you think you're doing good by
recycling
something.
And they are, and it's really, all consumers are. So only 2% of the plastic packaging that we put out into the world every year, which is 78 million tonnes of plastic packaging, only 2% is actually closed loop recycled, which means it's recycled back into something useful, like a water bottle.
Even if it's put into the recycling?
Even if it's put into the recycling.
What happens to the rest of it then?
It's burnt, incinerated, landfilled, escapes into the environment.
So when my wife says, as I do the recycling and I sort of feel good about it, she says, yeah, but I know what happens to it.
Yeah, exported, so there's loads
She's
of fraud
sort of right.
with the exporting. We are exporting our waste to countries that
so next,
can't really
I mean, I don't want
it.
To be discouraging about you recycling, but it's kind of close to useless.
Kind of, yeah.
Is that true of everything, not paper and cardboard?
So you've got much higher with paper, card. It's just plastic is such a difficult material. And the problem with plastics is that it's so complex. So not all plastics are created equal. So you've got plastics, laminates, covers, you know, and we just have this creaking recycling system that was just never set up to deal. So there's been a massive rise in on-the-go eating. So if you think of all of the snack wrappers, crisp packets, Lucozade bottles, all of that, our recycling system was never set up to deal with it. Yeah, Lucozade's the worst because they've got a wrapper around a bottle, so it's totally unrecyclable.
I was thinking it used to come in a glass bottle, but it did always have a cellophane wrapper around it, and that's not good, is it?
It's not. They are dealing with that. I shouldn't totally pick them out because they are dealing
Sinner.
With it.
Okay.
Sinner.
Cling film's really bad as well. We shouldn't be using cling film, right?
No.
And also, it turns out like we were all ingesting this plastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's everywhere. It's in our water. It's in the fish.
But also from a... No, but not. It's not even like the fish eat it and then we eat the fish. It seems to be sort of from the plastic.
There is, I think, an incoming amount of scientific research. I'm not a scientist and I'm not going to make any dodgy claims.
Fine.
But there is incoming...
Leave that to Jeff.
No, but there is incoming research that I think is going to show just how bad this plastic is for human health, just in terms of eating food that has touched plastic.
Right.
And just it breaking down into microplastics.
Yikes.
So what else can we do then? What can we be doing as consumers who are feeling terrible about this?
And what should governments be doing?
Okay, the problem is at the minute, if you want to shop without plastic, it is really, really hard. So there are an amount of zero waste shops. So there's about 30 or something in the country now. So in lots of towns and villages all over the country, there are zero waste shops. So just start Googling and see what's locally. You can also just try and take your own containers into your local shop. So you could go into your local butcher, your local bakery, you create a shopping bag full of other bags. So now everyone's used to taking a reusable shopping bag. All you need is a reusable shopping bag with a load of smaller bags, some Tupperware, a few random items in it, and just take that with you and just politely ask the shopkeeper to put your product in the packaging that you've bought.
We need an internet solution, don't we?
We do need an internet solution. So hopefully this is what Unpackaged is going to be working on, is actually trying to harness these sort of technological progresses and say, actually, how can we create a solution that's scalable?
Something we're trying to get going on the podcast is sort of people will often want to feel powerful. Are there people that they can be writing letters to or contacting on social media? What's the specific thing they should be asking, and who should they be asking it of?
I think they should, well, the action of taking your own containers or trying to buy your own containers, buy food in your own containers in supermarkets, will send a message, because that will all start filtering up. Oh God, all these people are coming in with their own containers. We better look after them. Calling things out on social media, writing to the chief executives of supermarkets. There's quite a lot of campaigns with kids in schools writing to their local supermarkets asking for less plastic. So I think definitely that kind of consumer pressure will help, because then they'll see there's a market for it. Because when I started, it was so niche and so small that yes, you could see why the supermarkets would turn around and say, well, no one's interested. But since Blue Planet, everyone's interested, but there are no solutions. You know, everybody needs to play their part. So shoppers need to try their best to refill things, and you know, consumer pressure, retailers, manufacturers need to redesign supply chains to offer reusable packaging, and then government needs to bring in legislation to make it more expensive to do the wrong thing.
So speaking of government, on this podcast we dream of a glorious utopia where I'm the benign leader. If I was to appoint you
speak for yourself
environment secretary, what would be the first thing you'd do on day one?
So I was having a think about it, and what we really need, and actually our government could do this now really easily, is a standard of refill and reuse. So in the same way that we have food hygiene standards that cover all forms of restaurants and retailers, what we need is something that encourages reuse. So it says to a cafe, it's fine for people to bring their own coffee cups, you just need to follow these principles or these hygiene standards to make it safe and hygienic for them. So that's actually something that we could do tomorrow and would be really, really easy.
Great. Catherine, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Listening to the end of that, I'm delighted to say we've been joined by Julian Kirby. He is, I think I can only describe him as the plastics czar at Friends of the Earth. Is that fair enough?
I'll go with that. Yeah, okay.
Czar? You don't mind being called the czar, do you?
Yeah.
Czar Julian the First.
Czar Julian the First. Of plastic.
Of plastic. So just talk to us from your point of view about the scale of this problem. Because it feels pretty big.
It's not only really big, but I think we're getting a sense every day of the extent to which it's bigger than we thought it was. So probably where most people start and stop when they think about plastic pollution is excess packaging, supermarkets, throwaway, single-use things like coffee stirrers and so on. That's maybe a third of what we estimate is going into the sea. Probably a fifth comes from car tyres. So when your tyre goes bald, where's that gone? That's synthetic rubber, and that is classed as plastic pollution when it gets in the sea. Maybe a tenth, maybe more than that, comes from clothes. So microfibers washing out of clothes. A lot is spilled by industry. They're called nurdles, or mermaid's tears, little bits of plastic. And maybe 10% of what's going to sea comes from plastic before it's even ever been made into anything. And it's rubbing off of paint, and it's rubbing off of, you know, all sorts of other things. The point is, it's coming from so many more sources than many of us realize. But also there's a lot of it that's kind of like missing in the environment. So we can't account for all of it. And it might well be that a lot has settled to the bottom. Who knows what it's doing down there? I'm talking about the bottom of the sea, obviously. A lot of it is probably floating in the sea in very, very small particles, you know, nanoplastics or microplastics that we're not measuring, aren't aware of. It's got into the food chain and so on. But actually an enormous amount is on land as well. 80% of sewage sludge in this country is spread on fields. And that sewage sludge, the water treatment plants, they filter as much as they can to obviously make sure that they're not just dispersing all sorts of particles and pollutants out to the sea. But that sludge that's been trapped before the filters contains all those bits of plastic that have washed down the drain from our clothes, from our cosmetics and so on.
This is horrendous. I didn't realise there's all this unaccounted for
that's
plastic.
That's right. And that's why from one week to another you get another story. And like just this week we had the story about
ingesting plastic.
So, I mean, which was kind of obvious in a way because a study last year showed that between 3 and 10 tons of plastic every year settles over the city of Paris. So that'd be coming from the clothes, the carpets, the tyre dust.
Over,
and all the rest,
as in?
Across the city. So it's in the air and it settles out. And then
so like
we've got what's on the
almost.
Fields. Dust, exactly. So
and we don't really know what the implications are for human health. We know it's pretty bad for fish and so on.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. So that there's very little research done so far on human health. And what's been looked at so far has been the visible stuff or you know, the microplastics that you can see in fish guts and so on. So we're like, well, you know, people are probably eating that. But the worry is the really small microplastics or the nanoplastics. So that's, you know, really, really infinitesimally.
What are microbeads? Sorry, I've heard this word.
Okay, but so microbeads are tiny little solid bits of plastic that are put into or were put into things like shampoos and cosmetics and so on. So we've got this much vaunted microbeads ban. In this country, it's only partial, so that only affects rinse off things like shower gels and shampoos and so on, and it doesn't cover sun cream. So some creams have it in.
I'm sorry to be stupid, but what's microbeads? Well, why were they in the shampoo in the first place?
And they were in toothpaste. So we're brushing our children's teeth with
plastic in there. What was the purpose?
The point was to give it granularity, the different functions, give it granularity, to give it viscosity, to allow it to be spreadable, you know, all of those sorts of things. So the ban in this country removes from a lot of those sources. Yeah. But it doesn't affect cosmetics and so on, so it's still in your lipstick. It doesn't apply to sun creams. Now, many sun creams have got them out, but not all of them. But it also, it covers the solid bits. And the thing about plastic is that it can actually, the polymer that it is made from, it's called plastic when it's a solid, but it can be in a waxy form, a gel form, and so on. In the product, and when it gets into a different environment, be that in something's guts or in the cold sea, then it can turn into a solid as well.
Right,
so the point is it's all over the place.
At this point I can feel collectively our listeners hiding under the duvet and sort of wanting to sort of avoid the world.
But there's some good news here. It's caught the public's imagination.
Yeah. So Catherine was saying how her business has gone up massively as a result of Blue Planet.
Now, the good news, I think, is... You know, have we ever seen such a public response to an environmental crisis? You know, I've been doing this for longer than I care to mention, and I haven't. And we've got big things like, you know, climate change. We're like, you know, wake up.
Yeah.
And we are seeing progress on that, and we've seen, you know, really good developments in different parts of the world or so on climate change. But the public response on plastic, I think, eclipses, you know,
and was
all
that
of
the,
these other things.
It was just Blue Planet that did it.
Well, it was growing and growing before Blue Planet. Now, I think to be fair to Blue Planet and the makers of Blue Planet, that really was, you know, a knock right up a few scales. But I think it first entered the public consciousness in quite a widespread way, probably in the early noughties when some Californian fishermen discovered this mass of plastic floating in the middle of the Pacific. And then it sort of went away a bit, but it continued to grow and various bits of the media were talking about banned plastic bags and so on. So it's growing and growing. Blue Planet, whoomph. And then the BBC Drowning in Plastic just recently.
Yes, indeed. We're talking Liz Benin's documentary, which is very good.
That's right.
And I recommend it to Jeff. Now, the government's made some announcements. Take us through what they've announced and sort of how far it goes.
Yeah. So broadly, with respect to plastic pollution itself, because this is an issue that cuts across, you know, waste and pollution management, you know, more generally than that. What Mr. Gove is planning, so this is the Environment Department, is banning plastic stem cotton buds, plastic straws, and plastic coffee stirrers. So those are classed as needless, pointless items that can be got rid of. I think a lot of people would support that, although it's really important that we remember that there are certain people that really need plastic straws. So people who have disabilities can't use paper straws or steel straws, and that's a really important consideration. If we're going to ban something like plastic straws, make sure that we properly think about it and what the impacts are and accommodate people who are going to still need them. Across the fence at the Treasury, you've got plans to use the tax system to minimise single-use plastics. So things like disposable coffee cups, maybe, or takeaway tubs. So we're going to hear about that probably by the time you air this, actually. But the DEFRA announcements, GOES announcements, will be probably in a few weeks' time. And he's also looking at, getting a bit broader, the waste and recycling system, so making it easier for people to recycle and such like. Is it enough? They're good things, but it's piecemeal and it's fragmentary and it's a time tiny, pardon the pun, drop in the ocean of the amount of plastic pollution, you know, that we're creating. I doubt it will come close to even thinking about plastic pollution from car tyres, from the clothes that we're wearing, from peeling paint, from all of those other sort of uses, as well as plastic-stemmed lollipops. You know, it looks and feels exactly the same as a plastic-stemmed cotton bud. Why would you not ban that?
If you were Minister for the Environment in the Jeffocracy, this is the stuff you would be doing in addition to the government's proposals.
I think, and it would be an honour, I think that actually the thing that I would look for would be a proper application of what people call varyingly the polluter pays principle or sort of related to that producer responsibility. So if you're going to market something, then and sell it and make money out of that, then you have to have paid for the impact of that on the environment and on society. And what we've got in this country is the companies that market a lot of we think is rubbish, whether it goes in the recycling stream or in the black bag bin, they pay about 10% towards the cleanup of that stuff. In much of Europe, they pay 90%. So it's the other way around. And we really need to get to that situation in this country where if you are going to make stuff that has an impact, that has a need to clear it up or remediate it in somehow, then you need to be paying for that. And then what that does is drives those companies to think about, well, is this going to cost me? Maybe I won't sell it, or maybe I'll design it differently. And I'm sure there are other reasons behind this, but it's probably not a coincidence that we have much more packaging and single-use rubbish created in this country than in similar economies like Europe, much, much more.
What are the harder things to do that we haven't yet talked about?
Well, we've touched on car tyres and we've touched on clothes. The problem with synthetic clothes, so most of us, you know, listening to this, you and I, are going to be wearing a bit of plastic on us somewhere in our clothes.
Now, I'm sort of horrified to learn that.
Yeah, I think, oh, isn't that going to be a bit sweaty? Yeah. But it's such a sort of prevalent part of our clothing these days that something like 2/3 of new clothes now are synthetic clothes, are made with plastics in some way. And you might say, well, let's just ban it. But the problem is that cotton is also an absolutely awful crop in terms of environmental impact and in terms of social impacts. Like in Uzbekistan, where a lot of cotton comes from, basically the country is enslaved en masse and sent out to the fields to pick it. You know, there are awful, awful environmental and social aspects to cotton farming. And even organic cotton would, you know, requires huge amounts of water and land and so on. So would be a case of out of the frying pan into the fire if we just said no to synthetic clothes. But there are things that individuals can do.
And nudism,
of course, would work in some countries better than other. Let's put it that way. I'll be up for that. Don't like wearing clothes much. But social taboos dictate that I have to. So, the thing about synthetic clothes is that they shed microfibers. And those microfibers are a type of microplastic. And as I said earlier on, those microplastics are actually really, really bad in the environment because they gather toxins and get into food chains. If you wash your clothes less often, if you wash them on a slower spin cycle at a lower temperature, if you don't ram so much into the washing machine, there are some bags that you can put synthetic clothes into. Guppy bag is one. I think another one is called Coral or something, that collect the microfibers. You know, those things can help to reduce. But also companies should be, that are making marketing this stuff, should be installing filters on their drains to collect the microfibers there, because they're mostly shed in the earlier washes. But also, and this is a role for government to make this happen, there should be standards, and there could be standards around ensuring that clothes are only designed to the best standards so that they shed as little as possible. And if we have those minimum benchmarks now, and we can say that the best performing one now can be the minimum in 5 years' time, then that provides, you know, a route towards minimal pollution.
That touches actually on something bigger that we wanted to ask you about, which is the balance of this problem. How much of it can be sorted by us as individuals versus how much needs to be looked at by industry versus how much needs to be looked at by governments or indeed sort of international cooperation of governments?
So there are things that we can do as individuals, but what we really need to get across, not just to us all as individuals, but to the companies that make and market this stuff, to politicians that set the framework we all live in, is that there's only so much we can do as individuals. And actually, I think it's about time we all express pretty vocally that we're fed up with this mantra that it's all about individual choice and change. We've done a bit. People recycle as much as they can, and they do that stuff around, you know, looking, checking the labels or whatever. But what you need, for particularly for something like plastic pollution, which comes from so many different sources, and some of them are trickier areas to look at. And, you know, you and I aren't clothes designers, I guess. I'm not anyway. So, you know, I can't dictate what happens there. That's why you need, you know, government direction. You really do need hands-on government with this to say, right, what we have to do is get to an endpoint of near zero plastic pollution. And there are things that we can do right now. We can get rid of needless and pointless plastics. But whilst doing that, we need to identify the essential ones, whether for medical use or for accessibility and disability reasons and so on. And what are the hard to replace ones that we're going to have to work over time on? And then let's get to work with working to figure out how to get rid of those. And that requires legislation that would make not just this government, but future governments work towards that problem as well, because it will take decades. So we could get rid of the majority probably of plastic pollution now, or a big chunk of it, like really quickly in the next few years. And we should and we must do that because we're in a crisis here. But also be working over time. And that's what we have in this country pioneered globally with the Climate Change Act, and we could take a very similar approach with plastic pollution.
And how do you coordinate this kind of stuff internationally? Because I was looking before in terms of the plastics in the oceans, China and Indonesia and the Philippines are sort of the three biggest pollutants. Is the something that's equivalent to, say, the Paris Agreement that can be thrashed out, people talking about doing that kind of thing?
So there are plans at UN level to create an international agreement around plastic pollution. It's really important to back up a little bit and think about, right, well, is it really all coming from this country or that? Now we export huge amounts of our, quotes, recycling. It was going to China. They've now said, we're not having this, thanks. It needs to go elsewhere. Why are they saying we're not having it, thanks? Thanks, because it's really poorly sorted. It's highly contaminated with other waste streams. We haven't got our act together in this country to you know, make sure that the recycling collections that we do are properly sorted, so that the reprocessors who buy the stuff can turn it into new, you know, essentially it's raw materials again, and turn it into new stuff. At the moment, they have to pay again to get it resorted. And because they can't afford that, it gets exported elsewhere. So we're kind of literally dumping our rubbish on other countries. And that also has a huge social impact, because not all of that stuff is then recycled over there. It's left in tips. It gets into the environment. So actually a lot of the pollution that's coming from countries like the Philippines and China and so on actually comes from this country or Germany or European countries or the States or whatever. But also the companies that are making and marketing a lot of this stuff, whether it's, you know, your soft drinks companies or your shampoo companies, who've decided, right, here's a new market here that we can really, you know, we can penetrate this market, and we'll figure out how to do that. We'll sell individual shampoo sachets instead of bottles. They do that. They aggressively market this stuff, knowing that there is no infrastructure there to collect it and that there is no culture there to deal with this stuff. And so to say, well, it's kind of their fault they're creating the mess, is, you know, that is actually quite an important nuance to the issue there, which needs thinking about.
One other question that I've got goes broader than plastics. You know, we've talked both with you and Catherine about the way in which the Blue Planet and so on really awoke public consciousness. What lessons do you think we learn for wider environmental and climate issues from this? Apart from the fact we need David Attenborough. I mean, to be fair to David Attenborough, he's been talking about climate a lot.
I mean, that's a really good question, isn't it? And just my personal opinion, this isn't a Friends of the Earth opinion, my personal opinion, because, you know, everyone's speculating. I think that if you give people something that they can kind of relate to, then that really obviously turns something that's an abstraction into a real issue. Yeah. I worked in Australia on a big campaign to stop fracking there, and the thing that really resonated with people there was the impact on water and the industrialization of the bush of you know, country around them, and we did focus groups, and they were all concerned about climate change, but their responses were, you know, like, I really get it, but I can't really relate to it. It doesn't sort of make sense to me.
Can't relate to it as a problem or as a solution or both?
Probably both. Yeah. And I think that's the thing about plastic, is that people can see it and feel it. And in a way, it's been an awakening, because quite literally, we have stepped over it as an issue for decades. It's been there on the path in front of us. I wish that wasn't there, and you walk over it. But there has been that flip by Attenborough and Blue Planet and you know, others, of course, really getting that energy going. But there's also always been this background thing that I think people have a sense. I mean, it's in the culture. It's in, is it the Kinks, Plastic Man? You know, the use of the word plastic has always been a little bit of an insult. There's always a bit of a sense of it's not a very benign thing. So I think the lesson there, if there is one, from my speculation anyway, is just to really, really go to where people are and how it makes sense to them. And
showing there are solutions, actually.
Showing their respect, absolutely.
I mean, we've got a really clear idea of the problem, but there's plenty to feel optimistic about. I mean, I feel optimistic about, in a way, that with something like just as the plastic drinking straws, fairly much nobody was talking about that a couple of years ago. And now if I go out to a pizza place, they don't give you straws anymore in some of the chains. So there's cause for optimism there, right?
I think there's so much cause for optimism. What's the cliche about the Chinese expression, in a crisis is an opportunity or something? Or it's the same word written different ways or something.
Right.
I don't know. I don't read Chinese either. but it really does feel that way, because we have just an unprecedented level of public concern and energy and desire to do something about this, and to do something serious about this. No more fiddling on the margins and blaming it on, you know, individual choice and so on. And that level of energy is driving corporate culture as well as political culture. And there's a reason that you know, the politicians are saying, all right, we're going to ban this and we're going to do that. Now, they're insufficient, but it's an open door that we can and should kick at.
Tsar Julian I of plastics, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a great honour. Thank you.
So what do you think?
Well, I mean, firstly, I feel awful about thinking that just by washing out my plastic milk cartons and putting them in the recycling that I'm
and also
I'm
that daily Lucozade bottle.
I think you're confusing me with Daily Thompson. I don't even drink that much Lucozade. No. Only when I'm poorly.
Your secret has been revealed.
It was you who brought up Lucozade.
Wrongly accused on Lucozade, yeah.
But sort of the scale of the problem and how little the difference the things that you think you've been doing up until this point and up until this became a big part of the conversation, you know, sort of realising how little we've been doing up until now, really.
I mean, it's obviously not simple. Government could obviously be going faster. I mean, I suppose the two things I take out of it are, one, the consumer pressure point that Catherine and Julian made, which is, you know, consumers, I don't think you can solve it on your own as a consumer, but consumers signalling that they care a lot about this will provoke change, but it's got to be accompanied by government. But secondly, I'm just really struck, because been thinking a lot about sort of climate change generally recently, and what do you do? You know, we had this horrendous IPCC report about the, you know, 99% of coral reefs go if we have 2 degrees of warming, which used to be considered the sort of tipping point. But, you know, I think it should give one optimism that you can, if people think a problem is real, caused by us, and soluble, then you're sort of getting there. You know, because I think it's the thing about plastic is that it's sort of what Julian would say, you can grab onto it and people feel it's a soluble problem. And I think somehow we've got to sort of break down the climate change problem into that, so that people
into
think...
Into manageable chunks,
so that people think this is a soluble problem.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you've got thoughts on what you've heard about plastics or suggestions for future episodes, please do get in touch. We read every email extremely attentively. You can find us at Cheerful Podcast on Twitter or on Instagram. You can also email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com or Facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. And also, I don't normally say this, please do, if you like what you hear, rate us on iTunes. As Jeff knows, I'm a regular follower of the iTunes chart. And which I think demands still a judicial inquiry. It's still a piece of outstanding business because I don't understand it. But do rate us, and preferably with 5 stars.
You want to be top of the pops.
I want to be top of the pops. Right. This comes from Sean Kelly, who is in Seattle. And I think it shows that our back catalogue is, you know, available. Sean found episode 22 on arts education. And he says this: "Hi, Ed and Jeff. I found your podcast a few months ago and I've attempted to catch up. But with a busy life, I'm still far behind. However, I just listened to your podcast episode about curriculum in schools, and I realised that what you were talking about with arts is exactly what happened to me and what I see every day. I was an awfully shy kid, and my mum signed me up for a summer theatre camp, and it changed my world. I loved it, I got friends, I opened up, my confidence grew, and I kept with theatre and the arts through college. I currently own a pottery studio in Seattle, where I teach adults the art form. I utilize all of the skills I developed through the arts to manage my business successfully, other than just the art that I am teaching. I also see the desire for these adults to pursue a hobby that is healthy for their life and to participate in the amazing community we have developed at the studio. I'm saddened to know that kids these days aren't getting the same intro to arts that my students received 10 to 15 years ago. Additionally, as kids, they don't necessarily have the option of seeking out arts and community if it isn't available in a school setting. Love your podcast, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. And I mean, that's definitely something we'll revisit in different ways as well as time goes on. This comes from Andrew White, who says, reason to be cheerful, a big idea. Right, here goes. I can make the whole of the United Kingdom happier and healthier.
Wow.
Without necessarily spending much more money to do so.
Wowza.
Says, my big idea will reduce everyone's mental stress. It'll make them less frustrated and satisfied, more satisfied at work.
Better salt in dishwashers.
Danger of illness, mental illness, depression. He goes on, bold claims.
What is it?
You may think. Well, he says, you know, he's building up the tension here.
Yeah, I am. I'm feeling tense.
Says, so what is the big idea?
Yeah, what is it?
Is it mass hypnosis?
No.
Is it drugs?
No.
Is it magic?
No.
No, he says. It's going outside.
Oh.
That's it. Basically, if everyone went for a 4-mile walk every week, fantastic things will happen. All the benefits I've listed, and you know, I think we just touched on the benefits that he's listed, are actually proven to come from regular exposure to the outdoors. There's plenty of research. The problem is, in this country, we've systematically hindered and in some cases stopped the ability of people to get outside. He then cites out of town shopping centres, and you know about the effects that these can have on sort of surrounding town centres. How difficult it can be with the parking and national parks and the money that costs.
I like this guy. Don't you find going outside? I mean, providing you're not like consuming lots of air pollution, don't you find going outside, going for like a walk, exercise makes you feel better?
I mean, sometimes
it always changes my mood. Seriously.
I mean, I'm quite an indoorsy person. Like at school, I always liked it when it was indoor playtime because it was raining.
Yeah.
That would mean I don't have to go outside.
You're not a bad walker, though.
Oh, I love a nice amble around, yeah. Yeah, I think this is great. I mean, because of time, Andrew says his hometown is Doncaster. He's a writer and filmmaker and broadcaster, and he's got lots of ideas around this, which we don't have time to go into now. But yeah, definitely. I mean,
good.
I think there's really, really something in this. Another one here. This comes from Edward Pennington, who says, dear Ed and Jeff, I really like the recent episode on worker ownership. It's always nice when Ed taps into his inner radical. It's in there somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not far from the surface.
It's true.
Ready to come out. Exactly. Like a gremlin at midnight.
Yeah.
But I felt there were some questions unanswered. In particular, why should BlackRock or another wealth management company have more control over how things are run than workers, let alone 90% control? It's hard to understand how you would accept the logic of 10% but not demand more. I got the impression that it was very much seen as a starting point, wasn't it?
Yeah, possibly. I think, to be honest, there was a bit we edited out where Christine, I think, talked about possibly going higher. I think just partly for space reasons.
Yeah.
Well, not political censorship reasons.
No.
It was like starting people off with that idea.
Yeah. And also it was felt like 10% is a number at which you've got a good chance of becoming the majority shareholder. Yeah.
Well, really, sorry.
Or the largest single share.
Exactly.
On another note, I'm worried Ed is opening up political controversy by agreeing with the tough stance on dancing politicians.
Was I not quite positive about?
I think it was about whether you would go on a dancing show or not. I think that was the issue.
But I don't mind other people. I don't mind other people doing it. It's just I think it wouldn't be good for me.
Yeah.
Now the last one comes from Sally Watson, and it's about parkrun. I think this parkrun is becoming a running theme. She wants to throw her weight behind those people suggesting you should do an episode of the podcast on parkrun. It's my own best reason to be cheerful. It goes to the point about exercise and being outside. I started parkrunning last year. I'm going to be doing my 50th in the next few weeks. I get out a lot out volunteering, which is just as much, if not even more, of a feel-good activity. I'm sure you already know this, but parkrun is growing exponentially. You're welcome to attend on your own or with friends or with your kids or babies in a buggy or a dog or to volunteer. People who walk around their 5K course in over an hour are just as welcome, Jeff, to take part as the speedy folk who can run it in under 20 minutes. There is a volunteer.
Didn't
called...
you fall over the last time you tried probably. To go running?
There is a volunteer role called Tail Walker, which I've done a couple of times, which makes sure that none of the other park runners who might be a bit worried about being slow, a bit reluctant to take part, Jeff, comes last. It's also lovely how many of the park runners stay around the finish area to cheer on. You could be cheered on those who finish after them. The average finishing time at park run is currently 29 minutes. That's 29 minutes for 5K. That's pretty quick, it seems to me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's 6 minutes per kilometre. And it's getting slower, which park runs is a good thing because it means that more people are taking part who are not typically speedy runners. Every park run has a designated cafe in which all the park runs, I mean, honestly, I'm really sold on this, are welcome to have a coffee and a chat afterwards. Social aspect is as important as the running. There are junior park runs, 2K events on Sunday mornings, springing up all over the country for 4 to 14-year-olds, which are brilliant and inclusive. As a means of tackling social isolation and loneliness, the fraction of communities, social division and mental health problems, as well as the more obvious issues like obesity and poor physical health, Parkrun is doing amazing work. With best wishes, Sally Watson in Aberdeen.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at cheerfulpodcast.
And here with
droning on.
I meant one.
Droning
I was
on.
Wait until Rich went, and I was going to explain to you that I didn't mean.
Listeners, as we were having a conversation with Rich before he came on, do you want to introduce Rich?
Yeah, Rich Wilson is here. Hello,
that's nice to be here.
Jeff said, "I was saying how difficult it was to do stand-up comedy," and I said, "I suppose it's a bit like a speech." And Jeff said, "Well, I think a speech, like some droning on speech. I don't think it's anything like that."
Here's what I said: I said it doesn't matter.
Droning on.
I said it doesn't matter as much if you're droning on in a speech, and you, because of your baggage, heard you not as one, but you heard it.
Don't bring
as
my
you.
Baggage into. I left my baggage by the door
with your shoes.
Anyway, with my shoes, yeah.
It's anyway, a wonderful thing to Rich walk into.
It's very nice to have you here. I'm sorry you're in the middle of our marital.
Yeah. Oh, unfold your arms.
The Atmos is really turning.
Exactly.
Oh, reason to be cheerful, you two. Exactly.
Exactly. Hey,
Rich, you've brought along some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. What do we have first?
Okay, I think we should go back to having a day where... basically, we just shut down all the electronics. You know, remember Sundays when we were kids? I know people say it was boring, but, you know, it made you do things as a family. Like, you had dinner and you did things together.
Yeah, I like this idea.
I know it sounds
old-fashioned. So no email?
No email, nothing.
And is it just like a big central lever? We just pull a central lever, blackout. Electronic blackout, no internet.
Yeah, like in Frankenstein when they pull the lever.
Like an Amish day. We all get to be Amish for
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only thing that doesn't switch off is your fridge freezer. Because no one wants to be eating smiley faces and prawns for tea.
No.
When you have to eat all the food that's defrosted.
TV, yes, no?
Or maybe TV, because we said we had TV when we were kids. But I think
maybe go back to three channels.
You go back to one channel and it's the Queen's speech on a loop.
Yeah.
I think it's just that. I think we need to get back to just having a day where, you know, we have dinner together and we're made to go to the zoo or go and do things
Sort of fiddling on the iPhone. Do you practice what you are now preaching?
Of course not. I'm one of the worst. I mean, my girlfriend and I have just moved into the smaller back room because we had proper blackout curtains, and what we've made it into is a very sort of tranquil area just to sleep. And we keep saying to each other, right, no phones in the bedroom. We might watch something like Netflix on a laptop, but no phones. And we've been in there a week and we've yet to do it without phones. There's always a reason. It's like, I've just got to send this email. I've just got to check on this. The worst thing is that you expect there to be a barrage of texts and emails.
Nobody cares. That's why it's playing with your brain, you see. Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm basically buying this.
Yeah, I like this
electronic
too.
Blackout.
Definitely.
Just for a day.
All right, Rich, what you got next?
I reckon we should have big foam hands on the front of the car to twat people back into the bushes when they step out in front of you. Because there's been a...
Where are you that people are emerging from bushes?
Oh, it's not necessarily bushes. So many people keep walking into the road. I've seen it so many times. And you end up in your car going, dude, don't step out. And they can't hear you. You're like, don't do it. Mate, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? People don't seem... I think maybe... I don't know whether...
Are you an attentive... But Jeff doesn't drive. Are you an attentive pedestrian?
I think I'm a pretty good pedestrian. I've said to Ed before and said on the podcast before, I used to spend a lot of time in Sweden. Right. And I think in Sweden there's this idea that we've got to follow the rules because everything works so perfectly. If we just break one rule, it'll all start coming undone.
Yeah.
And you get a situation where in a small town, there'll be somebody standing at a pedestrian crossing waiting for the green man, even when there's no traffic on the road.
Right. Yes.
Which is the other extreme.
Which is too far,
but that is interesting because that's what I sort of do teach my children. Even if there's a red man, no traffic, you don't really cross.
Because you never know what's going to, what to expect.
Well, it's more like then they'll think, well, you can cross at a red man.
Yeah, true.
But generally, adults do it too in Sweden, is that right?
Yeah.
Foam hands. Anyway, you've got foam
hands. Yeah, so a big foam hand on the front of the car. So it just comes out and it buffs you into the nets that are erected.
Okay, we'll have that. Yeah. What else you got, Rich?
I think that young people should go and spend time with old people for an hour, a couple of hours a week. They should have to go and.
So a young person like Jeff should go and spend time.
Bring them round.
That's what this podcast is, basically. Yeah.
To help Jeff get outside and.
Yeah, it's me, the young person.
Yeah. Jeff thinks himself as a young person.
Sorry. I thought we were coming to help Jeff.
No, Jeff.
So we bring him.
We're sort of indulging his generational fantasies.
I do apologise. So we're coming around to help
youth
Ed.
Work. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's going to come and visit with me.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of, yeah.
So this is what this is. It's already happening.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're
bridging
the
generation gap.
Exactly.
Right.
All 3 years. No, I think that's a good idea. 4 years.
Yeah. Just to underline that.
It's because I spent so long droning on in those speeches.
This is going to run, isn't it?
I think it's really good. Yeah, there's that program on Channel 4, which I only saw a little bit of. It's called something like The Secret Life of 4-Year-Olds with Older People.
That's right,
It seems amazing.
They're taking children to care homes.
Exactly, that's what it is.
And they were doing that, and you could see the energy in the old people. They were buoyed by it, and...
Well, so there's such a generational divide.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, particularly Brexit. there's definitely something in this, I think. But it's just a question of how you make it happen. See, I think what used to happen is that people used to move about less. So we're less geographically mobile. So they would kind of know the person down the road. I'm not sounding like I want to go back to the 1950s, but, you know, and I think somehow how do you recreate that?
Yeah, I think you're right. With all these suggestions that I've made, it sounds like you're an old man. You know, going, we should go back to the...
It's the right thing, I think. When I was first became a constituency MP, there was a big argument in one part of my constituency between some young kids who were using a multi-use games area and the people who played bowls, who are older people. And I remember, I think I brought them together at some point.
The old people skateboarding and the young people playing crowd green bowling.
It sounds a bit too fantasy, but... And I remember thinking at the time, ignorance of each other, it breeds sort of suspicion.
That's right, yes.
What's your final idea, Rich?
Okay, I think we should train actual wolves and big cats to respond when somebody wolf whistles or cat calls a woman.
That is a deterrent.
Yeah. Imagine that. If oi, oi. And then this big wolf just comes flying out.
That savages you.
And you'll learn a lesson.
It's quite sort of tough love in the rich ocracy,
isn't it? I think it's what we need. Do you know what I mean?
I
think it's time to go back to basics. Listen,
I know.
One strike and
you're out. Worked for John Major. It's definitely like, you're part of the community.
Part of the community, but don't
You've got the foam hands, like hitting you to the net. You've got the wolves.
So you've released the wolves into the community. What's to stop them not savaging somebody who hasn't wolf whistled?
You've just got to be careful when you're whistling. Absolutely. Well, it's all about the training. Yeah. I think we invest money in that, Ed. Definitely in the training of the wolves.
It would just would be classic me and Jeff to be standing by somebody who did the wolf whistle and then sort of get attacked by the wolf, as that person sort of gets off scot-free.
There's going to be blunders. There's going to be collateral damage. It's not perfect system. Yeah. It's a different film.
It's better than
teaching the wolves.
I mean, it's basically the philosophy that it's better that five innocent people get savaged to death than that one guilty person goes free type
Absolutely.
Of thing, basically.
Yeah. See, this is the way forward. Yeah.
Rich, if people want to come and see you, you've got anything doing at the moment?
I am to be found in comedy clubs up and down the country. I am on Twitter. I am Rich Wilson. I'm on Instagram.
What's your show called?
My particular show is called Still Relevant. And I'll be doing that in the next. I'll be doing that next year.
Maybe that's what my show should be called.
Question mark. Is there a question mark?
Droney.
Yeah, exactly. Rich Wilson, thank you so much for having me.
Lovely. Thank you.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So here we are in the eerie outro.
Rent-A-Ghost. Do you remember Rent-A-Ghost?
Yeah. Was it Mr. Meeker?
Yeah, I just loved Rent-A-Ghost.
Dobbing the horse. Yeah, it's one of the times
you
a year
when... your spirits move.
That's very good. You should do that in karaoke.
Yeah, I think not.
It's one of the times when I miss being on the radio, because I would always go a big bundle on Halloween and play the Monster Mash.
Really?
I would, I'd always play Herman Munster singing Dem Bones, Dem Bones, Dem
Dry
Bones.
I love the Munsters.
Yeah.
The Munsters, the Addams Family, I love those things. I'm a sucker for American soap.
Me too. I love both those things, but I think you're supposed to pick a side. I think you're supposed to be either a Munsters person.
Really?
Or an Addams Family person.
And I like the Brady Bunch too.
Well, there you go. That shows that you're not partisan.
Eclectic.
Yes. Case. So, yeah, have a good Halloween.
Yeah, thank you. We should do a thank you, shouldn't we?
We should.
I'd like to thank Catherine Conway and Julian Kirby.
And thanks to the marvellous Rich Wilson for coming on and sharing stories and ideas. Emma Corsham produced our podcast. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seed composed the music and the artwork.
Emily Power.
Now, Emily Power's a real Halloween person.
Is she?
She's got a touch of the kind of death metal-y thing too. She loves spooky things. I think Halloween is like Christmas for her.
Wow.
Yeah. So there we go. We're done. Enjoy your spooky budget.
Fantastic.
Yep. He's been Severed Ed Miliband.
He's been Ghoulish Jeff.
And these have been
Reasons.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.